I should have said the poet. I should have said the poet. The poet.
Sending poets. This is Sending Poets, a podcast about the beauty of life. We call it Sending Poets because of the movie Contact, that line when Jodie Foster goes through the wormhole and says, they should have sent a poet. With me is Bob, and today's episode is part two of three in a series about the human evolution of consciousness. Super excited about getting into this. I saw in your note, in the note, Bob, you have something listed here, a cave within a cave and something about Star Wars. I can't wait.
Yes. What is your familiarity with Star Wars? Have you seen the three originals?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, many times, many times.
Very good. Very good. Okay, so the reference I'm alluding to is the part where Luke goes, he's with Yoda learning some Jedi skills, and he tries to, so it's probably Return of the Jedi, I believe, maybe. I can't recall. Second movie?
Part of Empire, perhaps? Too, right?
Yeah, it's the part, well, here's the part. It's the part where Luke goes in the swamp, like under a tree in a cave, and in the back of the cave he finds Darth Vader, and he strikes him, and it takes the mask off, and it's his face.
Yes, okay. I think that is Return of the Jedi, yes.
That might be Return of the Jedi. And Yoda predicted this. He's like, you know, in the cave will be your greatest, you know, enemy. That's your greatest test or whatever, right? And so it's playing off of this concept of going a level deeper inside before you can take a step outside. Meaning, this Star Wars is all predicated on Joseph Campbell's work. I think we've mentioned, you know, in conversation you and I previously, Joseph Campbell, very famous anthropologist, historian, and he documented 1,000+ cultures that have similar archetypal paths that their heroes journey upon. And one of the first steps of the journey is not to go out, but to go in. So George Lucas borrowed heavily upon this work from Joseph Campbell and created this more beautiful metaphor, maybe not more beautiful, but another layer, which is Star Wars. And Star Wars is pretty much...
I didn't know that.
It's pretty much word for word or station to station, the journey, Luke's journey as the hero of 1,000 faces, meaning it's all the same story just told many different ways, the same stages. And it makes sense, though, because we're all the same kind of human, right? So if you're going to write a story reflecting your condition, cultures in different times and places, having never communicated with one another, do share a commonality, which is their humanity. That's the beauty of it. It's the signal that is this universal signal within the signal. So going back to the cave, before we go out, we have to go in. So let's catch up from the previous episode. First episode, we talked about gaining bipedalism and the locomotion driving cognition. And our evolutionary pathway is, you know, a pursuit animal, pack animal, planning ahead animal, taking water on the walk kind of animal, but also a dangerous, dangerous animal. The most dangerous animal. And so we begin to spread. We begin to spread. We walk. We cover territory. We adapt. We walk. We cover territory. We adapt. And eventually, let's say we start getting to some caves.
Mm-hmm.
And so these caves are not, you know, human caves. These caves have been used for hundreds of thousands, millions of years by any animal that sought shelter in a storm. Okay, by any animal that was evading pursuit by a predator, by any animal damaged in the fight, looking to lick its wounds. So these are not specifically human creations. These are not, you know, our one and only, excuse me, testament to our genius. We are adapting into the local environment. And the cave literally just keeps you dry.
Yeah, you know, it's part of the hierarchy of needs, right? It's like shelter. It's like base needs,
Haslam's,
right?
Yeah, Haslam's hierarchy of needs, correct. So we have this, all of living creatures have needs, and there is a timeline of the hierarchy, and this is one of the preeminent basic needs, 100%, John, 100%. So we have this basic need that is fulfilled not through our doing, but through nature. And here's why this is so important. We didn't create this thing. It's a mystery to us. Mm. And so as we both literally and metaphorically enter this cave, meaning becoming consciously self-aware that there is another level here to drop into. So if you are at, you meaning just say a buffalo or some kind of, you know, some kind of other animal on the plane, so to speak, not a lot of consciousness there. So there's not a lot of level to drop into. Humans are developing this predictive modeling capability, and that comes through multiple stages of this cognitive pattern. So you have to have an extra level to view your output. We'll talk about that in just a second, but let's kind of summarize this cave within a cave. So Luke, you know, has this demon he has to fight. But the metaphor is, it's you, right? The demon is not out there. The demon's inside. The demon is your cross you have to bear that you'll never be able to conquer it out there. You cannot do it. It is not a dragon you can slay. It just doesn't exist in that format. And that's what the big confusion is, because you think you can vanquish this thing. And the reason why this is so powerful is the observation of understanding is your position is not to be the vanquisher of this other thing. It is you. You are it. There are two things here working together. You can't kill it. It is you. You cannot say it is consciousness alone that is driving this ship. And the more we delve into this, I will propose, it's much the latter. It's subconsciousness doing much of the driving.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get. I know you know what I mean, and we'll get into it very deeply in a minute. But this is the first realization, meaning a literal format to the metaphor, the cave. So going into a cave literally allows us to explore what it means to have these levels. Okay. And let me grab for a second. What is that next piece? Yeah, please.
The flowchart of consciousness, subconsciousness.
Thank you. Okay. So now let's get technical on what I'm talking about as these two distinct layers. So not just a cave, but a cave within a cave. Okay. It's very, very important to have a distinction on these two layers. Let's imagine a flowchart, if you will, and we'll insert a image of this. But a flowchart, and so imagine in your mind's eye a blank sheet of paper, right in the middle, draw a box, and put model in that box, just write model. So that's your box, your black box of your model.
Mm-hmm.
In the upper left-hand corner, imagine a little circle that says input and an arrow going into the model. So you have input from the outside world, all the sensory stimulation that your body is capable of receiving. So there's not an infinite amount, but a very, very long list of different types of signals going out throughout the universe that you could be perceptive of.
Perceiving, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. And you could have X-ray vision. You know, you could feel... You could feel magnetism. You could know where magnetic north is, like geese do. You know, like they know which way magnetic north is because they have a cell in their body that is sensitive to the magnetic field of the Earth. There's all kinds of different sense, like a star-nosed mole. Right? Have you ever seen those crazy star-nosed moles that they're... They live in essentially complete darkness, and their nose looks like a starfish, meaning it's got all these little finger-like protuberances around a central stalk of their nose. And what they do is they touch their environment to make a mental map of it. So their primary sense is not hearing, it's not visual, it's touch.
Touch, wow.
Yeah, and so their nose can create a plot map of the tunnel they're inhabiting, and then they eat earthworms or whatever, so as they crawl around. Why would you have sight? Why would you have hearing? It doesn't help you at all. So they develop... this primary touch sensitivity. Anyway, the point is there's many different channels and we only have a few.
Mm.
So we have our inputs, which are your basic senses, you know, sight, hearing, touch, taste. What else is there?
There's five, right?
Yeah, there are five.
Sight, hearing, touch, taste,
smell.
Sound. Smell. Oh, wait, yeah, because what did I already say? Hearing, yeah,
hearing,
smell.
Yes. And there's a sixth out there, which is your... I'm sorry about that.
No, it's good.
We skipped our second grade class on sensory...
I know.
Things. There is a sixth, which is your body's feeling of position within a gravitational field, you know, what it feels like to be oriented a certain way. It's so ubiquitous, we don't even consider it. It is a thing, though. So we have these senses, okay, that these are our inputs into our model. And now let's imagine from the model drawing an arrow to the right of the piece of paper in your mind's eye. And then connecting to another box, which is an output. So you have an input coming in from the left, you have your model, and then you have an output. So this model is predictive, and this is what we were describing in the previous episode, as your chase animal. As it wants to hook left, you predict, oh, it's going to hook left so I can straight line and I can cut some distance off. It's going to go right. Yeah. I can do the same. You have this ability to, I think you had brought this to my attention. Is it 5 times a second? You have a threat awareness, right?
I got that from Irshad Manji. And she just says, the ego is scanning for threats. That's its job. And it scans for threats 5 times per second, you know.
So it's constantly giving you these little blips, these little frames of reference that predict if there's a threat or not. So normally you would just feel but not have a conscious awareness of this constant threat assessment because you're not in a threatening situation. But if you've ever been in a threatening situation or you can conceive of being in a threatening situation, your body triggers itself into a whole second gear. You know, a whole second ball game starts opening up and your decision-making layer drops away and you start reacting and things will just start happening and you're not going to have a moment of executive authority to back out of these things. You're just going to do what's going to happen and things are going to get crazy for a minute. And then if you're lucky and you survive this thing, then you'll narrate what just happened. But it's not the same as making the decision. Mm. So we have this output from the model of what I think is going to happen next. Now, we have the reality of observation. So this is the point of, was the model correct in its prediction? So the model cannot self-regulate. Did I make a correct assessment? It's just going to project, this is my output. And so another layer is needed to determine, was I correct or not? Was the model accurate? So if it is accurate, nothing happens. You did it. Yay. You know, applaud for yourself. Nothing else needs to happen. You were correct. Don't change a thing. Do that every time.
Keep doing that. Right.
If it is imprecise, incorrect, somehow you did not properly process the input and gauge the correct threat assessment output, or any predictive output, it doesn't have to be just threat, but any predictive output, you see it consciously. And if you're honest about it and not just rationalize with a narrative that justifies why this thing happened, but actually look at it and say it was wrong, mm-hmm. you are now going to update your weighted model. So there's another box we have to add to this model, which is the weights.
Mm-hmm.
So go back somewhere on the left-hand side and make a notation of weights. So let's talk about what a model is real quick. What we're talking about is essentially a giant series of knobs. I know that sounds weird.
Oh, yeah, yeah, no, like the Alan Turing, right? The like first, you know, it's like a machine like that. It just like, that's kind of what popped in my head
like
when you said like.
I was thinking like a soundboard or something where you have all these knobs that you can adjust every little tiny fraction of a piece that inserts into the master recording.
Yeah.
But the job.
Configuration.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. Curate the signal. So what is the pertinent signal? So you have all this input. Go back to the input. This is a global fire hose drinking lesson. You can't do it. You are not consciously aware of the global concentration of input sensory awareness your body is processing at any given second. It is massive. It is unrelenting.
Mm-hmm.
It is constant. And for some, we'll get into this at a later date, some are more sensitive to this than others. They feel things at a higher bit rate. They process this, you know, and get stuck perhaps. Hyper-processing small channels versus people who can digest larger volumes at a wider spectrum. So there's a lot of different variation here, you know, biological variation, but the concept remains. You have a series of, when I say knobs, what I refer to is each stream of your input has an ability to dampen that signal or increase its volume relative to the signal as a whole. So what we're talking about is like a corollary knowledge of the system, meaning you have to loop these things and then reference what happened after it. So there's no causal understanding of why anything is happening. You don't have to understand why. You just have to see this happened, then that happened, and then do that many, many times. And when you loop it, you get rid of all the extraneous knobs that don't really have an impact in that final assessment from input to output. But once you map it enough times, you will find a pattern. But there's only three knobs in the 300,000 that need to be looked at here. Those are the three variables that impact in a corollary sense what happened first, then what happened second. Now, they might not even be the same thing. It might not even be a literal causal connection. Let's go to Pavlov. So Pavlov would have a dog and he'd feed this dog. When he feeds the dog, he rings a bell.
Uh-huh.
And he conditions this dog so there's always a bell, then there's always food. Every time.
Yeah.
For like a year, this dog knows nothing but the bell and then food.
Yeah.
But there's no causal connection between a bell and food. He is just connecting them himself, making a a conditioned state. So he's conditioning the animal. Then he takes away the food. He rings the bell. Do you know what happens in the experiment?
Well, he can observe that the dog is salivating. Like the dog's body is like expecting the food and preparing to chew it and digest it and stuff. It's like those automatic things are like happening. It's expecting the food.
The model knows from this input.
Yeah.
My output is I'm about to eat. And then exactly what you said is exactly what happened. So, but there's no direct causal connection between the two. The dog is not consciously aware that the bell causes food. Because it doesn't. It's not the point of the dog's understanding. The dog doesn't have an understanding. It has a knowledge base on correlation. That this happens, then this happens after it. No need to tie them together other than that. But that's really useful. So that's the first level of the flow, which is having this prediction become an output. And then that becomes the job of the consciousness to observe the outcome, right? Was this a correct prediction? So let's go back to that. Now we say it was not the correct prediction. I'm going to update. So the weights now can be turned down for that signal so that in the future, we know that that path is unsuccessful and that won't be, you know, used again in that model. So this flowchart is a way to conceptualize the pathway of knowledge from a completely subconscious state of being, you know, animal just reacting in a instinctual manner, purely subconscious, and then having this conscious layer on top, this observer layer. And the final piece is once the observer realizes this process is occurring, they can then observe themselves observing over many times to determine causation. So once you realize what the process is, you can then iterate this flowchart over many instances to determine the bell is not causing the food to come. Now we understand. So we'd still be conditioned, but at least we would understand that
you're aware of it.
You're aware of it, that it's not connected. And so that's the big trick is that, hey, it doesn't have to be connected. Now, the smell of the food and then eating, I don't think you can disconnect those two things. So if you smell a delicious cupcake, your tummy's going to rumble. You know, I want that little cupcake now. I mean, that makes perfect sense, right? Because that's what we're triggered on. We're trying to, right?
Yeah. I mean, whatever it happens to be, like, I'm not a big cupcake guy myself, I get the point. You know, it's whatever thing you might be like, kind of craving, whatever, you know what I mean? Like,
but it's not a bell. The bell is disconnected from the reality of the thing. What I'm saying is if it smells good, it's probably going to taste good. The sound of a bell has nothing to do with the nutrition or anything at all. So
right.
Maybe it's, I don't know, fried chicken or, you know, juicy steak or ice cream or whatever it is that you love. That thing probably has characteristics that are pertinent to the thing and why you love it. Okay. So now we have this flow chart that breaks out what we're talking about with the subconscious and the conscious levels. But I feel definitions are needed. This is very murky water. This is a convoluted, complex concept. So let's make some definitions and let's try to tell some stories. I think the best learning is through stories. Okay.
For sure.
So here, For sure. Okay, so let's start with three main categories of comparison. So what we're going to do is we're going to define three main categories, but comparing subconsciousness with consciousness as we go. So let's begin with what we will call the point of view. So the point of view differential between subconsciousness and consciousness. So subconsciousness has a third-person point of view. And consciousness has a first-person point of view. So real quick definition, first-person would be subjectively through your eyes, seeing from inside your consciousness, your mind's point of view. And then the third-person is going to be like that bird's-eye view over your head, seeing all the actors simultaneously, everybody, just you, and the beauty of the objective point of view is you can see behind yourself. You can see all directions around, and you get a bird's eye view. Okay, so let's talk about, really deeply, let's talk about what that means in a strategic level of understanding of what that means, having different points of view. Now, I'm saying this is internal to a single person. They have this subconscious point of view where their cognition is being driven by this overhead approach of viewing all options simultaneously and not having a singular subjective point of view where you have a vested interest in you winning or something happens to you specifically that you're caring about. And, you know, believe it or not, you will justify probably anything and rationalize it any way you can, any way, shape, or form to get to the end result that you desire when you are playing as a first person versus looking at things third person objectively. But let's talk about the implications in a strategy sense. So here's the thought experiment. I call it the whisper game. And imagine in a whisper game, you have a gymnasium, like a giant school gymnasium. And you have one player playing objectively up on the bleachers, way up high. And they're looking down. And on the court itself, you have, you know, 5, 6, 7 dozen people all blindfolded, standing next to each other. And then you have another player who's on the court who's going to start the game. And what this player is going to do is going to whisper something to somebody in the first round. And then that person, every round, will start a chain reaction. That person can talk to somebody else, and then so on and so forth. And you'll see what I mean in just a second. But the concept of the game is the person sitting at the top of the bleachers can't hear what is being said.
Yeah.
And they're going to try to guess what the message is. Okay. The person at the bottom, they're trying to spread a message that, you know, this is a game, so it's just hypothetical, that won't be deciphered by the opponent. And so what will happen is the opponent will choose a point where they will guess from the third person perspective, I think I know what the answer is. And what they will get to do is choose one of the people that's down on the floor and test them, essentially, if they get it right or not. So it's like a test of how far the message spreads before. Because if you're down at the floor and nobody has spoken to you, you're not going to know what the message is. Okay, so here we go. Sorry, it's a little convoluted. I apologize.
No, I think I'm following.
Okay. So we start with the player on the floor. This is the subjective point of view player. He or she whispers into the first player's ear, round one. Okay, round two, that player whispers into someone else's ear. Okay, the next round, each of the first two players whisper into two more people's ears, and then the first player sits down. In the next round, those two players that were just whispered into, they whisper into two people's ears, plus the one other person that was still standing whispers into a third person's ear. And then that second person sits down.
Okay.
Then the next round, those three people plus the two people remaining all talk to somebody else. And then the two from the two rounds previous sit down. And we keep going. So the person on the bleachers is looking down, and they see one person talk to one person, then one person talk to another person and sit down, and then that other person talk to another person, and they stay standing. And so what you end up seeing is everybody talks to two people, then they sit down. And it spreads. So the pattern will spread, and the pattern that it spreads at is the Fibonacci sequence.
I was gonna like interject there, but I was like, I don't want to interrupt you, but I was like, that's the numbers are Fibonacci, right?
Anyway. That's exactly right. This is the cool. Point. So this, it's so cool because here's the point. Once you realize that, John, you can project forward any round you want and know exactly the state of the game. Wow. So here's the point. If you are playing subjectively, once the whisper goes in your ear, you know the answer, but you don't know where you're at in the pattern. You're blindfolded. You have one thing, which is someone whispers in your ear, repeat this instruction to two people, and then sit down and never speak again.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's all you get. But you know exactly what the answer is. So subjectively, if you are in the know, you are in the know. You know exactly what is happening because it's happening to you right now. But you cannot infer that pattern at a greater distance than mm-hmm. what you can feel. When you're playing third person and you're seeing all these outcomes from above, you see the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the differential between first person consciousness point of view and third person subconsciousness point of view.
Okay.
Next, excuse me, the next item of comparison is the type of reasoning.
Okay.
So let's compare the reasoning of a conscious entity, which is forward deductive, and the reasoning of a subconscious entity, which was backward inductive. So consciousness is forward deductive, subconsciousness is backward inductive. And let's break these down because this gets a little complicated. So let's start with the deductive and inductive, and let's just talk about what these things mean.
Yeah.
So to define deductive reasoning, it is to take a generality. It's to take a specific example and then deduce a generality out of it.
Yeah, okay.
And then inductive reasoning is to take a generality and induce a specific example of it. So let's do a thought experiment. Let's take a bicycle. Okay? Let's take a bicycle. So just before we begin, in your mind's eye, just picture a bicycle. Don't tell me what it looks like. Just picture a bicycle in your mind's eye really quickly. Just take 3 seconds. Think of a bicycle. Okay. Everybody's got a bicycle in their mind's eye.
Okay.
All right, let's start with deductive reasoning. If we take our bicycle and we say, I see two wheels, I see two pedals, I see a seat, I see handlebars or places you could put your hand that looks like it guides the front wheel. I see a chain that connects the pedals to the motion of the back wheel. Okay, so you are taking a specific example of this thing we call a bicycle, and you are deducing components of it, what their general usage is. So circles are really good for rolling things,
right?
Highly efficient transportation. A seat is really good for a human to sit on. Like, you kind of got to have one if you're going to be, you know, perhaps pedaling this thing. So the pedals look like they fit with your feet. So as you deduce all these principles that underlie the operation of the specific example, you now learn the concept of, this is what a bicycle is. Would you agree?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now go the other way. You have a concept of a bicycle. And someone comes to you and says, hey, I want you to build me a bicycle. And you'd say, well, what do you want to use it for? You say, I want to go mountain biking. Or I want to go dirt biking.
Mm.
Or I want to go over the road biking. Or I want to go, right? So all these different instances that you would then induce a specific example of from the pattern concept, the ideal of bicycle. So an expert who knows all the components of a bicycle will say, well, for mountain biking, we need big knobby tires and a very beefy frame and shocks and all, right? All these. And so if you're a speed racer, it's about weight and how many gears you have and how thin your tire diameter is, et cetera, tire width is, et cetera. So you can then induce specific examples of the generality to satisfy any need that comes to mind. So let me go back now and ask, what can you describe the bicycle you called to mind?
Yeah, this worked really well for me, by the way, because when you said just picture one, I don't know why, but what popped in my head was Pee-wee's bicycle. You know, Pee-wee's Big Adventure.
Yes, I do. What an iconic bicycle. Rip Pee-wee, by the way. Rest in peace, my brother.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Paul Rubens, for sure. And so,
Paul Rubens, great reference, John. I love that.
Yeah.
That's amazing that you did that, because I was going to ask you, and you did it without me asking. I was going to ask you, after you did it, where did the idea come from? Meaning, did you consciously determine this thing, or did it just pop into your head and you literally volunteered?
I think it really just came out of nowhere, because you were very, like, you know, I was going to say generic, but it was like generic and specific. It was like, think of a bike, but I didn't know where it was going. You were just like, think of a bicycle, and was like, boom, I got the bicycle.
That's the whole point, is that the emergence of the subconscious, it's not a conscious pathway, it's an observance yeah. of what is spontaneously generated. So I was using like a meta example in the example.
Yeah.
So they, so everybody listening can play along. So yeah. now I here's the beauty of it. You chose, because it could be like my bicycle as a kid. I remember my Huffy where I put the baseball card on the back. Nobody else can get that reference, meaning they didn't know exactly what bike I chose. You chose a universal reference that everybody can now explore what I'm talking about in their mind's eye. Meaning, when you investigate through your imagination lens, so your mind's eye, literally, as you can zoom and rotate and pull back and pan, and you're examining it. Maybe it's in black and white. Maybe it's in color. You're looking at the beauty's red, right? Or the red, white bike, I believe. Or what was the color scheme?
Yeah. It was like red and white, I think. Yeah.
Beautiful tassels. Yeah. I think it had a basket on the front or something, right? So as we all play the game, we're all being fed, meaning our consciousness is being handed the imagery induced by the subconscious in real time, proving what this flowchart is talking about.
Wow.
What a great example, John. What a great example. Okay, so let's...
And it works good for me, too, because if I could just say this, too, like please, when you started describing the backward inductive piece of it, and you know, you were talking about the specificity of, like, a mountain bike, and it was like, oh, wow. Pee-wee's bike is not good for riding on a mountain, and it really, like, I felt a lot of, I don't know, dots connecting, or maybe I was feeling my neurons fire in a way that was like I felt like I was learning. It was really like a fun thought experiment that worked really well for me.
I love it. I think it's that moment of awareness, right? It's a triggering of awareness. It's like, oh yes, I see it now. Right. It's not something that has to be like a special observation. You don't need an electron telescope or, yeah, I know that's not a real thing, but you know what I'm saying? You don't need some special device that gets you there. These little aha moments are all right in front of us, and it's about the pattern recognition. Once you see the pattern, it's like, oh, I see it. It's there. I get it. So I love that moment. Yeah, the wow. I love it. So, but you just mentioned backward induction, and we didn't cover the backward and forward. The directionality is really important.
Okay,
two flavors. So we just covered deduction and induction. I think you got it. I think you homered that example. I could never have made a better example. You demand. Okay, so we got this beautiful example of Pee-wee's bike. I'm going to use that forever is what I'm saying. I'm stealing that.
Oh, right on.
I'm stealing that. Okay, we got Pee-wee's bike.
You can have it, yeah, for sure. Anyway, yeah, okay.
And now we're going to talk about backwards and forwards. Backwards and forwards. Directionality of reason. This is really important to understand. There's a difference between connecting things in a causal chain as now and then forward versus having a backward point of view. And let's dig into this one. I would like to start with the backward point of view first. Let's talk about game theory. So game theory is technically backward induction. So it's using this inductive process of taking a generality, a principle, and then inducing specific examples, but it does so going backwards. And you only can go backwards, there's no time machine, by having repetition. It has to be looped, it has to be done multiple times. So you cannot achieve the backward part of backward induction on a novel experience. Mm. You cannot have a first time experience and utilize this technique properly. So this is why we talk about animals getting caught in snares. Okay, they see the tree bent over, they see the little piece of string, you know, disappearing as a circle on the ground. They see a tasty morsel inside the circle. Why don't they realize that this thing has all this stress built up in the limb of the tree that's bent over? And this little rope that's holding it is barely tied on at the bottom. And the tiniest little bump there is going to release its hold. And this thing's going to whip, because I've been whipped in the face with a tree limb before. I know what this thing is bent over. It's like shaking. It's so much energy is built up in this thing. It's about, but a little deer never realizes this, ever, not once. Never does it wonder what is going to happen next with this tree limb. They blithely walk into the noose. Because they get a one-shot deal. If they get one-shotted with something they cannot learn from in a Pavlovian contextual sense, they're done. They're done.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but they get the beauty of once you've played the game, now I can go backwards. So let me give you my example. You're at a restaurant. They give you, you're a kid, paper menu. On the back is one of those little mazes, you know, give you some crayons. So let's do the maze. Say it's got 20 openings. Well, each one of those openings, if you were to play the game forward, because you're looking from above, you're not actually in the paper having to go through the maze. You can cheat. You can look into the middle of the maze. But if you go forward from all the entrances to the finish line of the maze, you have a 1 in 20 chance, a 5% chance just randomly that the first pick is going to be the right pick. But if you start at the finish line and work your way backwards, you're eliminating all the opportunities, all the doorways that will never get to the finish line. And so maybe there's only two or three in the 20 that ever had a chance of reaching the finish line. So you are now going backwards from finish to beginning. Let me give you another example that I think further concretes this concept, which is playing golf. So playing golf, and this is going back to this, you know, some of the greatest golf players of all time, Jack Nicklaus, who is also a golf course designer, mentions that he not only plays golf, but builds his courses backwards. So as he conceptualizes approaching a hole, how will you attack this hole? What's your plan? Instead of thinking, here's my tee shot, I'm going to hit it as far and as straight as I can. And then I'm going to see where the ball lies, and I'm going to look at the hole. I'm going to try to get my next club and hit it as far and as straight as I can towards that hole. Wherever it lands, I'm going to then grab my next club and hit it as far and as straight as I can to the hole until I get to the putter.
Yeah.
Versus, I'm going to start with a 6-inch putt.
Yeah. How do I get there?
How do I get to that? Well, I could chip for about, you know, 90 yards. So this is I chip for now. Okay, so now I got to go to where I would chip from optimally.
Yeah.
Perfect swing. I know I could do it 9 out of 10 times. Okay. Well, how do I get to there? Well, I got a fairway drive to that spot. Okay, well, then how do I get to there? Well, I have to tee box drive to get. So working backwards, you have now optimized for only the conditions that result in 6-inch putt. Now, you may have three pathways. It might not be so easy. There might be options like in the maze. So maybe there's not just 1 out of 20 that gets you to the finish line. Maybe it's 3 out of 20. So now you have this opportunity of choice. So we as an observer layer, that's our executive function, is to not only observe what happens, but kind of break the tie. So if we have multiple opportunities, now we add in the forward directionality of deductive reasoning, and those two layers on top of each other form human levels of intelligence, okay? Now let's get to the last piece of comparison, the last and major.
Before we jump in there, can I just, because, you know, we both like, you know, cinematic references for things.
Yes, sir.
And I couldn't help but think about, in the way you were talking about the maze specifically, is that scene in Inception when Cobb is asking Ariadne to design a maze that, like, you know, design a maze that takes a specific amount of time to solve or whatever.
Yes.
He's kind of forcing her to, you know, think through, I think what you're talking about. And, you know, in the end, it is like a circular type of maze. And, you know, it's not explicitly said this way in the movie, but it seems like she must have been doing, you know, exactly what you're saying, is like starting at the end and backwards. And then, you know, the whole subconscious consciousness, tie-in in the movie, in the themes of Inception, are, I think, really fascinating in this conversation as well. But anyway, I want to
Bullseye. Let me just tag off of that bullseye, because the purpose of that scene is to show how ridiculous it is to build a maze for someone who goes backwards. You can't do it. When you realize the cause and effect have been reversed, all your little tricks disappear. All the dead ends, all the little, you know, if you're in the maze, if you're in the cornfield, all the little scary jumps, was, you know, Boogeyman, they're all gone.
Yeah.
So what the science realizes, you know, first the impact of the bullet hits, then the gun goes off. It changes everything. And that is the deeper level of understanding that Inception provides, or any of these things that provide.
Yeah.
When you realize there has to be a loop involved.
Yeah.
Loop means I already know the answer. I just have to find it. And the best way to do that is to go backwards from the goal to the beginning. So it's like, let's go to human behavior. The first step is so easy in a 1,000-mile journey, but it's the most important one. Because without that, there's no second step, there's no third step, there's no fourth step. But what induces that first step? It's a goal to get somewhere. So if you're going to go 1,000 miles, you don't just start getting to 1,000 miles by taking one random step and then taking another and another and another. And you realize, oh, I'm 1,000 miles. No. It starts with, I want to go to a place that's 1,000 miles away. And that builds that decision. Working backwards from that starts you in your direction of where you take your first step. Anyway, I love the movie references. Let's definitely add that to the docket. More of that. I love that.
Yeah. Right on. Yeah.
So the third phase of comparison. So we talked about point of view. We talked about directionality and type of reasoning. And now we're going to talk about memory.
Cool.
So the differential in memory between consciousness and subconsciousness. Subconscious has episodic memory. Consciousness has semantic memory. So episodic memory is contextual memory. It's related to what is happening in the episode of your state of being in the moment. So it's Pavlovian. It is the context of the bell and the food. Doesn't matter if there's a connection or not. It's what is going on, how your body is processing all that input to flow into your model, go through the weights, and give you a predictive output. That's all that is.
Yeah. And is observer like a good word here too, right? It's kind of from the observers, because again, it's third person. So it's that observation of it, right?
Yes, I think you could say that the best episodic memory has that third person bird's eye perspective that is grabbing everything, even that which is not consciously aware. Let's jump back to the beginning. A very fine point, by the way, very fine point. Jump back to the beginning. How much of the signal, the raw signal, gets tuned out in our conscious experience? So we are deluged with this fire hose of constant signal,
right,
that is tuned out, and all those layers are being processed somewhere else. So 100% agree. When you have the semantic-based memory, you have a narrative. You have a story that is going to justify what has happened and lock that into your memory as that's what happened. It's the testimony. It's your eyewitness testimony about what happened is your narrative, but it's always post facto. It's after the fact, what has already emerged from your subconscious to give you this thing, and then your justification for why that is the thing you've chosen. But you didn't really choose it. I mean, you chose it, but not consciously. It's like Pee-wee's bicycle. It pops.
Yeah.
It's in your field of awareness when you need it. But you don't have a catalog of all these bikes constantly running through your mind's eye of like mountain bike, speed bike, dirt bike, mountain bike, speed bike, dirt bike, mountain bike. You don't sit around all day long repeating the words of the 6-7 types of bicycle you want to think about someday.
Yeah.
But they're all in there cataloged and all visible objectively, to your point. So the only way to objectively view all these is from above. The whole layout, to see the big picture from above, gives you the ability to select individually what you want to then answer that question that was called upon you, that objective function. I want a bicycle. Imagine a bicycle. So you consciously say, I want a bicycle. Imagine a bicycle. You don't have the memory of the bicycle in your conscious mind. You're using this episodic recording. The reason why I would say episodic recording and not just subconscious, you know, inductive, providing that, I really want to dig into how much of the cognition is tied to the overall pattern and whatever you're aware of specifically. There's a really great story about different types of learning that inject contextualization into the system. I think it was Andrew Huebner who mentioned this. I can't recall specifically where I heard this first, but it talks about some random test. I can't remember if it was like a word game, a puzzle, some little arbitrary task that had to be memorized and learned. And then you would be challenged and tested on how quickly you could complete this task. And the experiment sets up with a group of scuba divers. And they go down 40, 50 feet, and they're in their scuba gear, and they practice this task, and they practice this task, and they practice this task for weeks, and they learn the task, and they get as good as they can. Then there's a test in a classroom for them to sit down and do the thing. And they do. They sit down, and they do the thing. When the experimenters test how quickly the person could do the thing in the classroom environment, it was slower than what they were able to do when they were fully trained underwater.
Mm.
So if they were tested again, they would not perform as well outside of the water, you know, scuba condition, you're underwater pressure, you got gear on, mask on, all this sweatsuit stuff, all this context that has nothing to do with solving the puzzle. Doesn't even matter. It's irrelevant. It's extraneous. It's noise. But it's context that your body uses to process something it is habituated to doing for you. And here's the kicker. The experimenters then ask the people to imagine you are in a wetsuit down at the bottom, 50 feet down, with the air mask on, the mask and all the bubbles and all the, and put yourself mentally in that point of view. And now they tested them and they reverted back to their fastest times.
Wow.
When they were underwater.
Wow.
So there's a connection between the context of memory and the actual understanding of memory. So let's go back to the other side and let's talk about the conscious memory that's not episodic, has nothing to do with the context of signal, has to do with language. So semantics, the words themselves.
All right.
So we had this conversation. I'm going to put you on the spot because I want you to tell the story. I'm going to lead off with mine. I want to hear yours. About masters of memory. So when someone is challenged to consciously memorize a deck of cards or some random, you know, it's random string of numbers that we're just going to give it to you, or random words or whatever, it's very difficult for a human
right.
to have the ability to store and recall a random set of information for more than just seconds. And so imagine the pinnacle of this, the top level, the people who are the champions of, I'll give you a deck of cards, you have 30 seconds to look at them in this order and then reproduce them an hour from now in
right.
the same order. And you've never seen the cards before, they're randomly stacked, etc. And so here's the technique. It's storytelling.
Yeah.
So the champion levels reference something they already know. And the example that I am familiar with is a guy who is a horse race better. So a guy who bet on racehorses for like 30 plus years, and he had memorized all these horses and all their track times and all their lineages and all these random associated numbers and variables stacked in with 30 years worth of horses, so tens of thousands of animals. But he had memory of these things. And if you were to give him a series randomly generated of words or numbers, he would then induce specific examples of horses that match some configuration, their weight, their age, the track they ran on, their fastest time, the fastest time itself, whatever the numbers or letters or words or whatever, he could find it in his subconscious database, and then he would assemble it into a narrative of a race itself. And he would say, I'm going to put these horses, these 12 horses, all racing together. And then as they start, he could tell the story of the race. And the story of the race would then encode the random generated, you know, whatever, you know, the ace of spades stands for 0-1, and, you know, 10 of diamonds is, you know, whatever, 10. So you could encode all these different pieces with details that you already know, and then put it in an order and tell a story.
Yeah.
And so is that familiar with what your understanding of this process is? Or I'd like to hear your example as well.
Yeah, I think hopefully I'm not like totally misremembering, because you did say we talked about this before, and I'm like, is this what we talked about, or am I like totally forgetting, which is totally possible. I could be totally, but anyway, my memory about this memory thing, I think it's a Veritasium video, but it's something I saw on YouTube, but it was like, you know, talking to actual like memory competition, you know, champions, like, you know, worldwide competitions of memorizing random numbers specifically. I don't think it was the, you know, decks of cards or anything. I think it was just random numbers. And it was storytelling is how these people do it. They would look at the numbers. They would just start associating, just kind of like you said, with like the this guy having this detailed database, you know, at the
ready. Like his street at home or something, his childhood.
Exactly. Like the first, the first four numbers might have been, you know, the house number. I think the person that they were interviewing, it was this woman, and she was saying, yeah, like, you know, I can just see that number and I know, I grew up, and now all of a sudden she has this context of like where she grew up. And so then the next like two numbers or four numbers, or maybe it's a seven number sequence. Oh, that's actually my phone number, or like, that's very close to a phone number. And it just filling in all of this and making the story, the narrative. And then, you know, and people can memorize like hundreds of numbers random in a random order. You know, I think they do get like 30 minutes, maybe an hour or something, but they don't memorize it.
They don't do it through the repetition. They don't just repeat it in their head. It's the conception of the narration.
Right. Associating it to the story that they can just start retelling the story, and, you know, the numbers come to them through that. So fascinating.
That's what you were thinking.
I was going to say, right? Or is there something
No,
else?
No. I think the first time we talked, I actually interrupted you, and I told the story about the horse racing because it was so important to me to get that one. That's been my classic one. But I remember you had one, but I have heard of that in the past, and I think I saw that Veritasium video as well. I do recall.
I think it was I think it was very good. Could have been something else, but yeah, I think it was.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, it was a great episode, and it does prove the point about the technique that it's involved. You cannot just consciously memorize random things without context.
Yeah,
consciously. You know, you can program yourself subconsciously in its Pavlovian sense to have these weird associations, and they just can spontaneously. You know, if you trained it, you can spontaneously create these things. Reactions, but. So those are the differentials then between the three stages of types between subconsciousness and consciousness. So we have that point of view differential, the type of reasoning, and then the type of memory.
Yeah, nice. I love it.
I think.
Good job.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
I think
this is going to be a recurring theme that we will talk about endlessly, but I really want to do definitions on this episode, and it's a little bit maybe dry and a little bit, you know, tougher to process all this abstraction, but it's got to be said at some point to lock in, because we're going to repeat so many times. We'll refer back to these examples, these thought experiments, many, many, many times. And that's really the key is to get the thought experiment, lock it in, understand why it works, and then that will be your trigger in the future to decipher something that's going on. You will then be prompted by your own subconscious, a la Pee-wee's bike, to give you the answer of the thought experiment in some kind of encoded, compressed form. That's your conversation medium between yourself and yourself. So when your subconscious wants to talk to your consciousness, it needs to have something that's not linguistic. It doesn't have a language. It doesn't speak in that way. It's not putting together a forward process. It's coming to a conclusion. It ran all the examples. It did every single one, and here's your answer. It doesn't know why, but this is your answer. And so that flash, that momentary, oh, Pee-wee's bike is the perfect example. I got it. I can see it. I know everything. So when you have that, now that's a clear-cut one. Now, sometimes it's not so clear-cut. Sometimes you have it in harmony. But most of the time, let's just say, most of the time, if you're in harmony and you're not, you know, in a terrible, like a bear's chasing me kind of moment.
Sure.
What do I choose? Do I run up the tree? Do I play dead? Do I knock my friend down and run past him? You know, what do I do? I don't know.
Yeah, what's the rhyme again? Brown lay down,
black
fight back, and white, then white say goodnight.
Say goodnight. I heard kneel and pray to the god of your choice or something like that. Say goodnight, though. I like that one. White is say goodnight. I like that a lot. Stacy's going to get a kick out of that one. Okay, so what I'd like now to is go back to the realistic example of a lot of this information we've just defined and illustrated from the flow chart and then the concept of cave within a cave and the definition of the different levels of cognition, consciousness, and subconsciousness. Now let's go to an actual example of a real cave within a cave, back to the human evolution component.
Yeah.
So walking is our gateway from the trees to the savanna, and then from the savanna to the rest of the earth as we walk our way to global dominance. But the cave is going to be really crucial to humans finding their true self. So in the first episode, when I talk about what that creature is, that evolutionary process, those are not modern humans. That's a condition pre-modern human. That's really early milestones of the change that occurred from, you know, long, you know, 60 million years ago or something like that. So now we're getting more into modern humans and applying something that people could be more empathetic and sympathetic towards is something similar to them. Imagine, you know, many animals would utilize a cave. Humans would be no different. Upon finding a cave pre-built, you would, if there's anybody in there, evict them and take it over, you know?
Yeah.
That could be cave bears, that could be, you know, buffalo or whatever. All these creatures have lived in these caves for hundreds of thousands of years, and scientists find, you know, layers of bones that are, you know, 50, 60 feet deep of all these bones that are on top of bones, on top of bones, on top of bones, on top of bones. And eventually at the top, you get, you know, fireplaces and human tools and, you know, butchered animals, etc. And so humans are aware of the benefits of having shelter pre-made, and so they're going to take advantage. And what we're going to talk about is not the first order of, hey, this cave gives me shelter, but the second order of certain people and their desire to kind of find out what's around the next corner.
Okay.
So there's a lot of diversity in humanity, a lot of different ways to solve the problem of what do we do with our life. And people are dealt a hand. You know, we were all born at a time and a place not of our choosing to people not of our pick. It's just the way it is, the way of the world. There's no choice at all. It's forced upon us. And not only, you know, who you're born into, but what time. And so the point is, imagine a very early time when life is brutally short. And it's a struggle just to find enough calories or to not be injured or to recover from an injury or to help somebody who is injured, who has to, you know, be fed now and you don't have enough food for yourself. So all these problems are so basic level, they would consume every waking moment, every waking chance of you to figure out what do I do next. So a lot of what we would think of spare time, you know, pleasure time, probably didn't exist. Probably tough. Right. So there's not, you know, not going to be a lot of artists, not going to be a lot of musicians, not going to be a lot of people who are specializing. So specialization has yet to really occur. We're a team of survivalists, you know, subsistence. But we're predatory. You know, we are dominant, and we're going to make our way. So there is a spectrum of, you know, we're on top. It's tough, but we are on top. And what I'm getting at is humans starting to utilize this little bit of extra that we have that's not, we're not so close to knife's edge of dying this second that nothing else matters. Because the consciousness really evolves out of spare time. It's not, the consciousness comes to play when there's nothing chasing you. Consciousness comes when you're daydreaming, and the consciousness comes when you're looking at things, and the consciousness comes when you're choosing what to eat or what to do next, or it's a luxury. Consciousness is a luxury. So as humans begin to enjoy the luxury, the status of being dominant, you can now build with this surplus something really amazing, and that is the society of the humans. So let's talk real quick about the benefit of this communicative level that humans achieve through pursuit hunting. So when they pursue hunt, just like African wild dogs, they do it as a team. And this team drives a form of evolution that's really, really specific to humans, this form of signaling. So something like the whites of our eyes, very unique to humans. So the ability for us to signal to other members of us where we're looking is a very powerful adaptation that humans can use to coordinate action. So if you know what I'm looking at, you know what I'm thinking about. And if you're looking at me and you see me looking at you, we both know what we're doing. So if you look at eyes of, say, chimpanzees or gorillas, they don't have that white scleral component. They don't have the differential between the colored part and a white part of their eye. All they have is this dark eye. Okay. You cannot gauge where they're looking at a distance. Humans have evolved a very specialized eye to show everybody where we're looking at.
Huh.
So we have this ability to signal, and why that's so important. Signaling shares the information level, which can survive past the individual level. And we are going to begin to accumulate what is culture, which is these sets of weights, presets of weights that will spread amongst a social group that you don't have to earn through trial and error, through conscious observance of your predictive model failing over and over. You don't have to do that. You can rely on generations and generations of waiting trial and error given to you to update your model right now. And the power of that concept is what differentiates humans from everybody else.
Wow.
It is so game theoretic optimal to share information. It is forced upon us. Blushing. Laughter. Sweating, crying, like nervous sweating, crying, these states of being, and that's for joy, crying for fear,
crying
in pain. So let's go back. Let's not go, because we'll do an episode just on the laughter and the crying, all this. You know what I'm talking about. So
yeah.
Let's not go too deep, but all these involuntary signals are intended to spread information amongst a population. It is not meant for you as an individual. Doesn't help you individually. It's not, it's at a group fitness level. All these things, blushing does nothing to save your ass, ever. But it is sending some kind of a signal involuntarily to a group of your state of mind, which is then able to be inferred what is going on in your model and reason with the context of the environment, what is happening and pull out the information from that, which gets stored in culture. So let's go back to the cave within a cave. How do we get to this next level event? I believe there are categories of people that are just built the way they are. Like a greyhound is built to run, and a bloodhound is built to smell, and whatever you want to call it. These are potentially very slight variations.
Okay.
But imagine you have an evolutionary team. Like an evolutionary team, like evolution has created a football team. Evolution is not going to create a football team. Potentially, let's just say, what if one version of evolution creating a team is make everybody into linemen. They're all really big and thick and strong, and they all can push everybody around. But in the game of football, you know, there's nobody fast who can run down the field and catch.
Sure.
Nobody who can throw the ball. So you got a problem. So my point is evolution on the team, on the not the individual level, seeks a diversity of skill sets.
Yeah.
It is strengthening to the whole. It is synergistic to the whole, that the sum of the parts add up in different dimensions. They're not all about blocking ability. You have to have catching ability and throwing ability and all these different, you know, coaching ability, all these different levels to synergistically form a winning team. So back to the cave. In Spain, there's a discovery of a cave. And in the back of this cave is like a little crack, a little fissure. And now I'm in my mind's eye of the first inhabitants of this, first human inhabitants of this cave. And how long it went from the first time they built a campfire and diced up an antelope and whatever they did until somebody got bored enough or curious enough to go explore the back part of this cave.
Yeah.
And find this little fissure. Okay. And at some point, someone's trailblazing, going into a place of unknown. There's no cultural reference to this place. There's no waiting. I don't know what happens next. It's novel.
Yeah.
It's risky. I don't know. It's dark.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's in there. Like you might never come back. If you were to try, like, how many people might have tried to go before you and failed and come back and said, I would never do that again? Or maybe they don't come back at all. And
they don't come back at all, yeah.
Brother dead, you know, he's gone now.
Yeah.
We'll pour a little bit out for him. But I'm saying it takes a certain kind of risk-taking individual who's not the average or the typical. They're very fringe. There's a very minor... It's like your kicker, okay, your place kicker. You need one on the team. You know, it's really important to have a great place kicker, but you don't need two or three or four or five or six. You only need one because he only plays one, play at a time, and one guy can kick the ball at a time, right? The metaphor is
right.
You don't need a lot of depth in certain positions. In certain other positions, you need lots of linemen, okay, because they get hurt a lot, and you need five or six of them just to do a job anyway because they block as a team. So you have this aberration, this wanderer who does not want to stop at the cave and just say, we're done. And this person finds some crack and has to see what's further back in there. And the point is, in this experience, this specific cave, and this is a very early cave, so the vast majority that have been found, I believe, are in France. And I'm talking about caves that have dynamic cave paintings in them. That's where we're going with this, obviously. There's something in there that's not just at the first level of the cave, the opening of the mouth. There's something in there that we'll talk about. But this stretches in many different places, many, many different places. But there's a time period that this becomes an emergent behavior for the first time. And that's what I'm focusing on, the very first time. Before there's a cultural tradition of this thing, before there's foreknowledge, someone has to take a risk, have an idea there's something back there. You would never take the first step without an idea there's something back there. I don't know what it is. Maybe I do know what it is. Maybe it's a dragon. Maybe it's a goal. Maybe, right? Maybe it's life. I don't know. So there's something that draws a certain person, perhaps, to explore this thing where everybody else walks by it. And the point is, in this cave in Spain, this crack is so tight and it gets so dark where you go, like dark, dark, like in a cave dark, there's absolutely zero light. You have to bring a torch or some kind of light source. Obviously, they don't have electricity. And the point is, what is occurring, the hypothesis of what is occurring is as you go deeper into this cave, you get a sense of lack of oxygen, hypoxia, where you become you become altered state. And there's a whole nother subtext. We'll take an episode on this, of like the stoned ape theory, the concept of the massive, like a million year period where the human brain doubled in size. It's massive. No other creature's ever had this that we know of. This giant push. Now, I have this theory, it's the walking, but I also have the concept it's walking with this exploration of psychedelic. So let's flash back. First flavors, sugar. Okay, sugar fermented creates alcohol. Alcohol's been with humanity a long time. I think alcohol is the first altered state to be inebriated through alcohol consumption, inadvertently through fermenting fruit or whatever. Then you get psilocybin. So Stacy told me you should add another flavor. I think it's like a umami or something like that, right? One of these like savory flavors that kind of encompasses like an earthy, like a mushroomy kind of, you know, a savory type flavor profile. That was definitely in the human's diet. And the prevalence of these psychedelic mushrooms in like cow patties. It's ubiquitous. You don't have to grow it. It's not a cultivated thing. They do their own thing. And going back to the risk-taking, humans taking risks and trying things out, experimenting. And then one guy tries it. He keels over and dies. Nobody else ever eats that toadstool ever again. Right. But the one guy who's the shaman who tries everything, maybe he takes the first bite and he goes to this, you know, dreamland and comes back with stories that you couldn't have believed it. So here's where we combine the two things that I think are happening with a certain type of individual. We're going to call him the map maker. So the map maker is the person who's breaking new ground, going into unexplored territory with the mission of bringing back information. This is the key part. It's not for self-improvement. He's not trying to go find the fountain of youth and be up in a cave somewhere for all eternity. This person or people who are the map makers are doing a job of defining the borders that are blacked out, coming back, and expanding the communal map. And why that's so important is because of darkness and because of this hypoxic state, this altered state. So let's go to the darkness first, and let's make a reference to a song. So we like to reference movies, we like to reference songs. So there's an Arcade Fire song, right? And this Arcade Fire song talks about, essentially, it's, you know, distill it down to light pollution. How sad it would be to have mountains upon mountains of suburbs with their lights and no real darkness. So lack of darkness prevents seeing the imagination, and that is the key to being able. When I say visualize, you know, a bicycle and Pee Wee's bike pops up, it takes darkness to see that bicycle in. So the bicycle is not just, you're not from inside the bicycle, you're from outside the bicycle, and the bicycle is in an environment of something. There's a negative and a positive of the space, right? You have the signal of the bicycle and then everything else. So I don't know if the bicycle you were envisioning was in a white background, if it was on a lawn somewhere, in a driveway, in a garage, in, you know, matrix free space, or whatever it was that you envisioned, the bicycle was in something.
I think it was like a scene from the movie is what it was, I think. I think I saw it like maybe even Peewee writing it. You know what I'm saying? I think that's what I saw. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So having that that context requires a background, a darkness that you can formulate a true simulation, a true projection of what could happen next. And so the constant light, let me just throw it out there, like your phone, a screen, a movie, something that's so bright that it grabs your attention, you are seeing with your actual eyes what you've evolved to see with your mind's eye. That's why it's so compelling, it's so addictive, is because it's so much brighter and more intense and powerful than your mind's eye. Now, I've gone way down the rabbit hole, so my imagination is quite vivid, and I know how powerful it can be. It's compulsive, even compared to a screen. It could be all-consuming, dangerously so. And so you really get a genetic predisposition towards like these shamanistic states of really falling into the mind's eye and experiencing the simulation, understanding what you feel is simulated, what you're experiencing is simulated, in that it can be changed. You can go into these altered states and what is real becomes not real, subjectively. and then journey back to reality and realizing there are layers to this game that we play. There's an information layer that corresponds to reality, meaning if you imagine there's a chair and you sit and there's no chair, you're going to fall straight down. But if there's a chair there, you're going to sit, you imagine there's a chair, there's actually a chair there, and it works. So when it works, it works. And that's a really good tool, but realizing it doesn't always work. Sometimes in the darkness, something emerges. And this is where this hypoxic altered state, maybe it's psilocybin, maybe it's alcohol, maybe it's cannabis, maybe it's whatever. I saw something the other day, I should have sent it to you, I apologize. It was a Madagascar lemur that would grab these millipedes that are highly toxic, and it would rub it on its body.
Whoa.
To disinfect itself, and it would make all the ticks and fleas and stuff flee its fur. But here's the kicker. After it does it, it bites the thing and nips it and gets a little taste. And then it drops it, and the little lemur's stoned for like an hour. Like heavily stoned, dude. Heavily stoned.
Oh, wow.
They enjoy it. I personally have seen cows eat grass that has turned with it's like this fungus ergot, and it's lysergic acid. It's LSD.
Sure. Yeah.
Cows will literally trip on LSD, I kid you not, on purpose. They like it. They like how it feels, like, for whatever reason. Like, sweet, dude, this feel, just trip it out. Anyway.
Yeah.
It's an altered state that is not always unpleasant. So we have evidence of consumption and evidence of traditional use, and we can backtrack on that and suppose that this was in play long, long ago. And it could have been a component of our evolution, in fact. So go back to the cave now. We've got this cave. Only one person can go at a time.
So actually, you know what? Before, can I interject a few things here?
Yes, please.
Because I think I know we're getting to the rest of the team.
Yes.
Which I'm super excited about. But I think it's a good time to mention, I'll put the link in the show notes that you forwarded. This article, it says ancient cave artists may have knowingly deprived themselves of oxygen to paint. So exactly what you were talking about in that article is so fascinating. Really, anybody that's listening, click on the link in the notes, because there is a map, like a sort of like cross-section of these caves and how deep they go. And it's gnarly. It's gnarly as hell.
Unbelievable.
And it was, altered state of consciousness is, I think, just endlessly fascinating to me. I think it started for me when I learned that much of what the DARE program taught me was based on scare tactics versus factual information. I think that just planted a seed that, like, oh, wow. And so I've been fascinated by that. So to read about, I think it's still, speculation maybe by these archaeologists, but that there was intent to go deep with fire that would, you know, drop oxygen levels to those states of hypoxia. God, it's just so fascinating to me.
Yeah, specifically because of the narrow nature, the carbon dioxide, which is more dense than the natural air, would settle at the bottom of the cave, even further reducing the already restricted airflow into the back of these cave systems.
Right. Yeah.
Dangerously so. You probably died. I mean, many people would probably have died.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like it. It just gets to the point where, like, if you, especially if you went by yourself, because, you know, past hypoxia is like you just fall unconscious and
yeah,
then
you're done.
If nobody's done. There to drag you out.
Yeah. You just get less and less conscious and then you just die. And by the way, thousands of years. I mean, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands. The number of generations to begin accumulating this cultural library of pre-weighted, information for your model. It took thousands of iterations of that to go. So I really can't even imagine how slow a process it was to go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. That just shows how impressive humans are. That once they're on the vein of gold, they will not stop until they explore where that thing goes. And I can very much associate with that.
Yeah, that's so cool.
Trail, once you're on that trail. Okay, but let's talk about the team, because the team is...
One more thing?
Yes, no, because
I want to talk about that arcade fire song.
Oh, yes, please.
Man, it's just like... So it's called Sprawl 2. I didn't listen to Sprawl 1 yet, but I was very taken by Sprawl 2. And then parenthetical mountains beyond mountains, and you kind of reference that, and that's in the lyrics.
Yes,
I just want to, like, because you've shared like several songs that are meaningful to you, and I had this epiphany last night. Kim and I listened to this on the patio last night, and this one consumed me, just took hold in a way that the other ones that you've shared just for whatever reason haven't. And I think what I realized is, like, I'm so much more of a music person than a lyric person. And then the epiphany I had is, like, obviously I am. I played in a death metal band for 15 years where we specifically told people, like, you know, because that's kind of a chief kind of criticism, I would say, of people that aren't really into death metal is, like, I can't understand the lyrics. Like, the vocals are weird. And we would tell people, like, that's fine. You don't really need to understand. Like, the lyrics aren't, it's all the music, you know. So it just hit me in a way of, like, of course I'm more of a music guy. So in the tradition of our namesake, I wrote some poems this morning. As I re-listened to it this morning, I started crying.
Beautiful.
And
oh,
that's like,
awesome.
And I was trying to think of, like, how to say this. So this is also kind of blowing my mind how this all these dots that connect. I'll get to it, but I want to read these two things I wrote. That I'm sure I have much to say, and sure that much of it I'm unsure how to say it. Which to me is like a Bilboism, like Bilbo.
One more time, because it's a little bit slower.
Yeah, I'm sure I have much to say, and sure that for much of it, I'm unsure how to say it.
Yes, the speech,
just,
Bilbo's speech.
I know there's,
I know exactly.
And so,
I like half of you as much as
I
should. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. It's exactly what was going through my mind when I was thinking that. And then, so I'm going to tie that into something else. But the other, because I wrote a haiku, because haikus are big, right? For both of us, Kim and I have been writing haikus forever, and I know you and Stacey write haikus. And I was looking at that, and I was like, oh, that's probably too many syllables. So anyway, I wrote a haiku, surely much to say, surely unsure how to say, much of what to say.
Wow, that is really good, John. No, that's really good. That is
so, thanks.
That's what we
so,
please continue, but that is really good. Well, I like that. I'm gonna have to get a screenshot of that. That's very good.
Yeah, I'll put it in the notes too anyway, just because, you know, hey, we're sending poets, right? There's like a thing about poetry.
Exactly.
So, like, every so often
haiku,
we gotta, like, throw these.
Haiku is the most compressed.
Exactly.
So there we
most
go.
Most meaning in 17 syllables. Anyway, so back to the Arcade Fire song. Yeah,
song.
I mean, musically,
yes,
it just grabbed me again. I don't know if I know that there's a reason. I know it's, like, hard to explain why. And then in addition to the music, and some of it is like the bass, like if there's a good, like, low,
nice,
simple bass line thing, I'm hooked. I'm invested and I love it.
The driving repetition.
Yeah.
Just a very driving.
It's beautiful.
Repetitive.
Plus, then the you know, there's melody that's really good too. There's like other higher keyboard stuff happening, and then on in addition to all that, the lyrics themselves are fantastic. You know, and
yes.
The part about dead shopping malls rise like mountains from yeah. mountains. So Kim and I were like, man, we have this mall that we grew up going to, and a huge chunk of it, it was the Sears portion of it, you know, went out of business, and it was this empty, huge two-story. They demolished all of it, and they put apartments in there, but the rest of the mall is still there, and it's just like, oh, man, it was just so gnarly thinking about that, and then the darkness stuff, and then I was like, you know, we live kind of in the suburban area. It's not out rurally. I feel like I'm probably at this point in my life where, like, we need to make points to go out away from city lights for that darkness. Like, dude, so all of that is really cool. And then I think going back to Bilbo, like, that, and coincidentally, because it's, I don't know why, but this has been Jay's hyperfixation for a while. He's been watching the Peter Jackson Hobbit movies on yes. repeat. His birthday was just a couple days ago, and I had got him the extended editions, so which have, like, you know, hours, tens of hours in each movie of behind the scenes stuff, and, you know, super fascinating. And we've been really watching a lot of that, and it's been like crazy interesting. And Bilbo's kind of fits in one of these. So this will tie back to the team now. I don't know exactly which role. I don't know if he's the map maker, but he's definitely this unique part of the team. He's going on an adventure. Like, he's, you know, Gandalf was seeking out somebody.
That's a great metaphor right there. Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, and there's a great scene that, you know, Gandalf, Galadriel asks him, like, why the Hobbit? Like, why him? And, oh, dude, the last time we watched, I think it's in the Battle of the Five Armies, the third one. But maybe it's in the first one. I'm sorry. I think it's in the oh, geez, I can't remember the subtitle of the first one, Unexpected Journey. Just, again, uncontrollably started crying the way that Gandalf was, like, explaining this good versus evil, like, major theme, you know, and how there's just something about Bilbo that just,
did you ever see the
words are just beautiful, man.
John, did you ever see the old-timey one that was, it was a cartoon, The Hobbit, the original cartoon one?
Like, yes, but I fell asleep. It was like, it was after the first Lord of the Rings movie came out, the first Peter Jackson Lord of the Rings. I think him and I rented it from a Blockbuster, because that's how long ago it was. But
yeah,
and it was hard to watch. But I've told Jay, I mean, you know, his fixations are pretty specific. So it's there. It's well, available to watch on, like, Max. And I'm like, we should watch it. I want to.
It's a very cool tie-in. I don't know if you'll get the reference, but the guy who does the voiceover of Gandalf in that cartoon version is the shopkeeper in the Gregory Peck version of Moby Dick, just so you know. I don't know if you know who I'm talking about. That guy is amazing voiceover. The guy who does the Gandalf voice back in this old-timey animated version. He has just the best voice of all time for Gandalf. In my mind's ear, he is Gandalf, the voice, he's just, especially in the Hobbit context. And I really like, because it speaks to assembling this team, meaning they show up with the map to make this team to go on this, voyage mission. And then they come back and there's another map for Frodo, et cetera. I think it's a most excellent encapsulation metaphorically. Love it.
Yeah. John Huston, I think, is the actor, right?
Might be.
I believe you're talking about.
It could be.
It looks like, yeah, I just looked up on IMDb, but.
Okay.
Anyway,
what's
yeah.
What's the year on that first, that animated one? Do you remember? What's the year on that?
Seven?
That sounds right. Yeah, it sounds right.
Yeah.
That's an amazing one. I would watch that over and over again. It's so dramatic. But it dovetails nicely and segues into this team component.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Cool.
So let's look at the team as, by the way, it's not necessarily that a person is one of these labels continuously, exclusively. It is not that way. Typically what happens is there's a formation period where everybody starts at essentially the follower level. So we're going to go through these stages in a second, but one could be, different situations. Let's say you're a hunter and you're, the map maker of the hunting party, but then in a different circumstance, let's say, swimming, where maybe you can't swim, but someone else in the tribe knows how to swim and they could navigate a river properly. So it's interchangeable, these levels. It's more about like the task at hand or what's going on. So some things that are in, a level of fitness might be a hindrance in different circumstances. So it's not a top down, like always. It's not really like that. It's more, it's about the circumstance, let's just say. It's circumstantial. So let's go through the categories. So map maker, map reader, and follower. Let's start with those three. Those are the three main categories. And this is all humanity. This is really important. Map maker, map reader, and follower. And so obviously as a child, everybody's, starts out, we all start as followers. We're trying to learn the system. We're trying to get the weights of our model tied to the culture of our tribe. Trying to use all the past knowledge, understand it, and become a productive member. But we don't know what we don't know yet. Mm-hmm. And that lack of awareness of your blind spot makes the game theory such that it's better to follow someone you trust without knowing why they're doing it than to try to figure it out on your own. So if you're a little kid and you're following your mom and dad as a hike in the woods, you probably should just maintain a visual connection and not wonder why we're doing what we're doing, but just make sure I follow in line behind mom and dad. So where they go, why they're going is irrelevant to you. It's not going to help you in any way, shape, or form. What you need to do is trust that they're going to take you where you need to go and keep you safe. And so if you try to figure it out, air quotes, and perhaps deviate from the path, thinking you have a better shortcut, you're going to split the team up, that's the recipe for disaster. So the concept of a follower is, I'm not going to have enough information, or I'm not going to be capable to use the information I have to create the final decision here. Hold on one quick second, John. I apologize. So the follower is not trying to make decisions. They're trusting the nature of someone else to guide the way, let's say. And that's a really huge superpower humans have, because you can rely upon a very experienced or highly intelligent, highly trained individual and essentially utilize that one teammate's decision-making ability and apply it to the whole group. And so imagine if you have a group, let's say you have a spectrum of decision makers. Well, if everybody's not making the decision, if only one person makes the decision, and you focus on making the best decision maker make the decision, and then that information can be shared amongst the entire group, you can take the best of your decision-making attributes and kind of convey that to the tribe as a whole.
Yeah.
So that specialization of decision-making itself is a superpower that humans have. And being able to maximize it is vitally important. So the maximizing of this information level is done through an abstraction. So we will abstract the territory with a map. So the territory is the actual thing, right? The territory is the ground itself. It is the rivers and it's the forests and the mountains and the deserts, etc. The map is a symbol of these things. It's an abstraction. It's a model of the reality. It's not the reality itself. And so what I'm saying is the ability of the producer of the map to hand that information off gives humans a level of fitness above all else. And this is the beginning of that process. This,
map making and abstracting of a reality into a usable format that can be shared with an entire, you know, team of humans.
Yeah.
And so originally what I will start with is you have the first creator. So the map maker, him or herself, is blazing a trail and creating, imagine you have a known territory and then outside the known territory, it's all blackness and just the map is uncharted. And so humans have been, you know, exploring the edges, so to speak, of our globe until we have everything mapped out.
Yeah. Right?
But imagine as you're making the maps, it takes one type of person to have all the kind of attributes needed to blaze the trail and be the first one into the back of the cave and the first one through the crack and the first one all the way to the back of the cave in order to uncover this magic area. So that first person breaks the trail. Now they are going to share that information with a number of other people, and everybody who can understand what that map maker has discovered, they can become map readers. So maybe this next level, the person is not the one who's going to go through the hair-raising, you know, possibly fatal endeavor of crawling into the back of this cave and getting hypoxic. But once you come back and tell me about it, I totally understand what you're saying. I'm going to use that.
Yeah.
Very, very, very critical that I use that information. So I don't know if you've ever heard this. This is an anecdote. Stupid people cannot learn from their own mistakes. Smart people learn from their own mistakes. Wise people learn from other people's mistakes. So being the wise one means I don't get caught in the cave. I take no risk, but I can use your information just like you.
Yeah.
So I have all the benefit. Now, the downside is I have to trust you, and it comes secondhand. But it's a really valuable level because the quantity of humans just by random, you know, this is the evolutionary pressure. This is how we got our team. You don't need 40 kickers, but you need a bunch of defensive backs or whatever you need. So it goes from like, hey, you only need one map maker to be the first one to go to the back of the cave. Because once the back of the cave has been discovered, you don't have to discover it ever again. Now, you could push in your exploration, but the discovery has been made. The seal has been broken. The culture now absorbs the knowledge and it's passed forward. So all those who can understand the cultural explanation and utilize that information in novel ways, they're the map readers. And then you have the follower level of the team that can visualize, hey, I see these individuals, they're for whatever reason, you know, many different reasons. Sometimes it's about looks, sometimes about how they speak, sometimes it's about social interaction and status, sometimes all different reasons. And this is a vital part of the puzzle, by the way, is the follower group, which is the most voluminous, the number of people is the highest in the follower group. There's many different reasons to choose who to follow and why.
Yeah.
And so there's a whole level of game theory underneath the other levels of game theory. So one level of game theory is the benefit of exploring and then coming back and sharing this information. Another level is, why should I explore? I'm not going to take the risk. I'll just wait till it comes back and I'll understand it. Then I'll use it. And then the next one, the next level of the game theory is, why would I trust you over this person? This one says go left. You say go right. I don't know which is the right one, but I have to make a decision. So my decision now isn't left or right. It's who do I trust?
Yeah.
And so you might say, I trust the old man because he's been there. The other guy says, I trust the young lady because she has great new ideas. So there's many different perspectives of many different perspectives of game theory going on in an emergent, self-organizing social situation. And evolution is pressurizing the fitness of humans in this arena, just like it pressurizes the fitness of long necks in giraffes. So the main, to re-summarize, the main components of this team that we call humanity are map makers, map readers, and the followers. And then once you get to a certain stage of development of prosperity, you have enough where you're far enough away from the edge of life or death that you can start picking and choosing winners amongst the team there's a fourth component called the broker. Okay. And the broker is the one that is going to obtain value by deciding inside the team itself how to apportion resources. So the broker is going to be intermediary between two factions within a team, either the followers and the map makers and map readers, or amongst the followers themselves, or amongst the map makers to the map readers. The broker's position is to get in between and intermediate some sort of decision-making process. And we can get into the implications of that. I think it's very deep and it's got its own its own whole podcast worthy topic string. But those are the four main components then of the human team framework archetypes. I mean, there's many subdivisions, et cetera, and people progress, and like you may be a heart surgeon. So in the operating room, you are the map maker, but maybe you can't dance. And so, at the wedding, when they put on the song and everybody starts dancing, and you're not the map maker anymore. You got to follow along, get the steps, because you don't know the dance. You don't know what the moves are, the electric slide or whatever. So it's subjective to the situation. It's relative. Yeah. That's the best.
We all fit in the roles at different times, probably, right? Throughout our lifetime. Isn't that part of what?
That's exactly the point. Yep.
Yeah.
And you can progress and retract, and it depends on circumstances. Like I said, it's relative and time and place and time of your life as you start as a young person. You can't have master level knowledge of blacksmith. You don't even know how to build a fire. How can you, make a horseshoe? You can't do that. So you're not the map maker of blacksmithing. So you have to start out as a follower of something. But that's the benefit. This is what I'm getting at. It's not a bug, it's a feature in that the humans have the capacity to onboard all this weighting to their model and not have to go through the trial and error. They don't have to be smart. They can be wise. They can use the story of what happens next without actually going through the experience level itself. And that allows humans to propagate advancement. And what I'm going to say, and then I'll let off because I don't know if we want to wrap here, but what I'm going to say is the acceleration of change is a function of this information layer, meaning as we accumulate and disseminate the weights more efficiently, more broadly, more deeply through our information system and our network, interconnectivity, communication levels on modern Earth, this is accelerating change at such a rapid pace because it's achieving this one, it's hyper-fixated on this one component, which is updating the weights of predictive models, essentially.
Beautiful. I think that probably is a good time to a good place to sort of wrap it up because it's a good cliffhanger, right? The next episode, I think, we'll really get into the modern age, right? And how all this stuff is really the role technology plays and stuff, There's a particular Carl Sagan quote I'll share that I have lots of thoughts about. So a little teaser for that in the next one.
Nice.
For sure. But
I think everything up till here is the deep past and then the recent past. And now what to do with the information will be the next episode. Essentially, arbitrarily, you got to choose, if you know the history, what do you do next? It's not a predestined thing. You have to make a choice in this world. And so that's what we can talk about next is how to use that information and arbitrarily pick a path. And we can argue infinite number of times different ways to do. And there's probably an infinite number of correct paths. Now I'm starting to sound like Bilbo.
Beautiful.
But yes, I think let's wrap it here and look forward to the next.
Awesome. Yeah. The next episode, so now what? Now what? Yeah, cool. Well, thanks for anybody listening. Again, the links in the show notes, check those out. And until next time. And thank you, Bob. And we'll
John.
Chat soon.
Yes, sir.